Okay. Well, let's look at exercise 18, finish that up first, and I'll have a few more comments about the test next Tuesday, and if we have some time, we'll start looking at chapter 19. Okay. I believe we left off, we did 16, didn't we? So we're up at 17. The bread was being taken by the man. Okay. Don't know where we left off in the rounds here. Does anybody remember? You just read? Okay. So that means Phil, you read before. Okay. We were coming. Yeah, I remember Phil. Okay. Yeah, Marty's up next then. Yeah, right. That's why that side of the class is so sparse. Yeah, number 17 on page 82.
Four toes, another toe, two toes.
Yes, good. Ho artos elambanato hupo tu anthropu. And it's just an imperfect form, and the present is not deponent, so the imperfect will not be deponent, and so it's just a regular imperfect form there. Elambanato.
Oh, that was 17?
Number 17.
Oh.
Yeah. Elambanato. So we want an imperfect passive here. It's actually middle or passive form. But see, the bread was being taken by the man. You have a clear passive structure and the agent expressed and so forth, so it would be a passive verb form. Okay, number 18, the bread will be taken by the man. Coming back over to John then, I guess. Okay, you have one syllable. Yeah, hupo tu anthropou. You want future passive here, will be taken by the man. So, yeah, I think you had
I've middle.
Yeah, you had middle.
Okay,
I understand. All right. Okay. So. Lymphthesitai. Yes, right. Lymphthesitai. Right. O artos lymphthesitai hupo tu anthropou. Lymphthesitai. Okay. Number 19, the disciple will learn the commandments of God. Jim, do you have that ready, or you spring surprise on you as soon as you get in here? It's number 19 on page
82.
Okay. Homathetes, mathesatai, right, mathesatai. And just be tas entolas tuthau, because it's plural. You know, I think you had to sing it, or you had tein etolain. It's the commandments here, so just it's tas entolas. So homathetes, mathesatai, just a future, and it's deponent. So it's got middle or passive type endings. Mathesatai, tas entolas tu theu. Okay, number 20, Eric. Okay, tas entolas tu theu, right. Okay, the homathetes emathen or emathe tas entolas tu theu. Okay, there's just your regular aorist form, and it's not deponent in the aorist. Okay, number 21, Army. Okay, emanthane, or emanthanen, optional new there. Right. So was learning, one of the imperfect form, and manthano is not deponent in the imperfect because it's not in the present. So it's just a regular imperfect form. Okay, so emanthane, or emanthanen. Number 22, Glenn. Okay, aesthien, right, artone, or aesthia if you didn't use the new, probably have a new on this because the next word begins with a vowel, so it'd be more likely to have it. Okay. Good. And don't forget the eta there on the for the augment. And this is an imperfect form, and estheo is just going to be regular in the imperfect, so you're going to just add your augment and have your normal endings. And third person singular is just an epsilon or epsilon nu. Okay, just for the interest of the rest of the class, I think Glenn checked on this estheo just to, out of curiosity to see if there were any passive usages of it in the present, and there aren't. So, nor middle or passive. Okay, no middle or passive. So, yeah, the form would be the same. Right. So, and none in the future either. So, it's kind of curious. I don't think there's anything that would preclude the possibility of such forms. They just don't happen to exist. Okay. So they're never saying something was eaten by something. They would probably just use an active structure for that, or maybe do use a different verb for eating or something. If it's an animal eats something up, sometimes you use, a lot of languages have different words for the way animals eat things and the way humans eat things. Okay. Isn't German, doesn't they have Essen and Fressen or something like that? Yeah. I remember. I can always remember that in German class because it was always we have to read from the Grimm's fairy tales, and they were really grim too. They were terrible. I mean, you would never want to read some of those things to a child. But there was always some monster that was devouring somebody, and they'd always use Fressen, they eat them, violently or something. In Hebrew, you can do things like that by changing vowel points on some of the verbs. They'll put an intensive form. And the PL is an intensive form of the form. So that's what you're perhaps more likely to see in cases like that. And of course, your apocryphal books would probably be loaded with words like, all these dragons and all this, this type of thing. Thomas slaying dragons and that kind of characteristics. Okay. Number 23, Kirby, I guess you're up next. The slave has eaten bread. Okay, you want has eaten. This would be an aorist, actually. You don't have a perfect to deal with yet, so you want an aorist form for that. Ephagon was the aorist form. So it should be hodulos ephagen, or ephage, probably ephagen, artone. Okay, has eaten. Remember, our aorist is getting translated several different ways in English. Has eaten, ate, and so forth would be aorist. Okay, so were you thinking present there? Or? Oh, wrong column. Oh, okay. Well, that'll make a difference too. Okay. Number 24, Mark. The slave will eat bread.
Arton phagetai hodulos.
Okay, phagetai hodulos. Okay, good. You just changed the word order a little bit there, but. Phagetai is just the future form here, so. It's just a complete suppletion. All right, number 25, and his deponent. Number 25, the disciple was an apostle. Now we're going to get some of the forms of the verb to be. Daniel? Yes, homathetes apostolos ein, or ein apostolos. Okay, eta nu, circumflex. Okay, number 26, Hans, disciple will be an apostle.
Homathetes estai apostolos.
Yes, homathetes estai apostolos. Okay, your future form there. Number 27, the disciples are apostles. Dale?
Homathetoi estin apostolos.
Okay, this is homathetai, which is a first declension masculine. Estin would be for the singular, though. You want the plural. So the plural would be what? They have the right tense, but...
Aeson.
Okay, aeson. Right, aeson. So aeson and aeson, third person, singular, and plural. So aeson would be the form you want. Aeson. Yes, what? Yes, apostoloi. Yeah, I didn't catch that one. Hoi mathetai aeson, aeson apostoloi. Yes?
Number 25 and 26, an apostle. Exactly. Do you say...
No, you just no article, because that's an indefinite article in English. If it was the apostle, you'd have ho apostolos, but it's an apostle, so you'd just say apostolos. Okay, same here. The disciples are apostles. No article on apostles. Okay, number 28, Steve. The disciples were apostles.
Voi mathetai
Apostoloi eison.
Eison, right, eison. What's nice in the verb to be, you don't have to try to decide whether it's aorist or imperfect. There's only imperfect forms. So eison, right. And I think, you know, the kind of the logic behind that is that to be is kind of a state of idea. It's got an almost automatic progressive aspect. I mean, you know, you usually aren't for just a moment in time. You are for a certain continuous, you know, section of time. Otherwise, it isn't worth talking about it. And so that may be part of the reason why they just, you know, didn't bother with the aorist forms at all. Okay, the disciples will be apostles. Price? Yes. Oimathe tai esontai apostoloi. Okay, esontai, future form. Number 30, we shall be disciples. Phil? Yes. Well, let's see. You would want mathe tai here, nominative, because it's still an equative verb. Even though it's future, we shall be apostles, it's still an equative verb, so you have nominative on both sides. So, hey, mace. Esomatha mathe tai. Okay. It's easy to see it in the present, but when you get in these other tenses, you know, you wonder, is it still nominative structure? And it is, as long as it's an equative verb. Number 31, you plural were slaves. I guess Marty's next. Okay. Yes. Humes eta douloi. Eta tau epsilon. Okay. Eta douloi. Okay, that's one you don't see real frequently. Second person plural is not a form you see real frequently, but that is the correct form. John, number 32, you will be a prophet.
Su es prophetes.
Okay, in the future, I think you had the imperfect. Did you have eta sigma there? Okay, it's you will be. You got an imperfect instead of a future. You might have just hit the wrong column or something. Yeah, essay. Uh-huh. Okay, su esse prophetes. And number 33, we were disciples. Jim?
Amen.
Yeah, amen. Amen. It's just there's no rough breathing on that. So sometimes you have to get a microscope almost to see whether there's some smoother rough breathing on some of this print when you get circumflexes in there and everything. But it's amen. Okay? Eta, mu, epsilon, nu. Okay, any questions on any of those forms? Yes? It's just pretty much interchangeable, I guess. I'm not sure what the ratio turns out to be, but the New Testament uses them both. What was that? Right. It's almost as looks form-wise. Right, one's looking like an imperfect middle, and the other one's looking like an imperfect active. So I guess you could consider it a deponent, the amatha deponent type of form. But this whole ending system is looking more of a yeah. Well, yes. It looks like an aorist passive with the eta, but then the rest of the endings aren't always lining up. You got that amen in the first person singular, so it's kind of a strange animal. Yeah, that's pretty good. Well, let's see, our aorist passive. Yes, except for the first person singular and the third person, see, you got ain, the aorist passive was just eta for the third person singular. This got eta new. But as far as the rest of eta, eson, amen, yeah, they all look pretty good there as far as their passive endings are concerned. That amatha would be kind of a reversion back to an imperfect type form. So they're both used, that's all I can really say.
I'm just wondering why the endings are definitely closer to the aorist passive
yes.
than the imperfect. Why
yes.
do they call it imperfect endings rather than aorist endings?
I mean,
you
just pass in. It's a good question. I think that they probably are deriving that, my guess is they're deriving that just from the nature of the verb to be and the progressive aspect associated with it. And we will see, I think it'll help a little bit when we get to participles a little bit later on, that they will use sometimes the verb to be with participles and it gives a very strong progressive aspect. So it may be because of the syntactical usage of the thing with other things we haven't seen yet. Right. Yeah, as far as syntactic function is concerned, it's functioning in the way that we would expect an imperfect to function, so I'm sure that's why the label got attached to it. But see, it's grammarians that come along and put these labels on anyway, so... Okay. But because I think the progressive aspect of the verb itself, the nature of the verb itself would lend itself, it's only got one past tense form, and you've got a decision, am I going to call this imperfect or am I going to call this aorist? And it doesn't really fit the way other aorists fit, as far as the way its usage is concerned. So I guess imperfect's the only choice you got left. All right. Any other questions on this chapter? Now, let me just give you a few more pointers as far as the test is concerned next Tuesday. I told you which irregular first aorist and second aorist that you'll need to be familiar with, so make sure you've had those marked in your textbook. As far as the test itself is concerned, a good portion of the test will be I'll give you a verb form in Greek and have you parse it out, basically. You'll have to tell me the person, the number, the tense, the voice, the dictionary form. You know, in other words, the way the form would be in the dictionary and then an English translation for it. So as far as vocabulary is concerned, you'll need to know the English equivalent, you know, of many of these other verbs that you've had. You'll be responsible for the verbs that you've had on your vocab quizzes up to this point, just the verbs. And for the deponent verbs that we marked, and for the irregular first aorist and irregular and second aorist that we've marked. So a good portion will be just parsing forms out. You know, I'll be giving the form in Greek, and then you have to tell me what the various characteristics of it are. Then there'll also be the reverse, where I'll give you the English. I'll just give you an English phrase that is covered by one verb form in Greek. In other words, I'm not going to give sentences. It's just going to be a phrase covered by one verb form, and then you have to give me the Greek. That's the harder part. And there will be some... There won't be any real direct translation aside from those things, but there will be some sentences where I put it in the active and you convert to passive and vice versa. So you'll have all the Greek there. You'll have all the vocabulary. It's just going to be knowing how to shift it, you know, shift the cases and so forth of the nouns and shift the verb form from active to passive or vice versa. So it'll be a few of those. And then the rest of it mainly is involving grammatical questions about the paradigms. You know that big paradigm system I gave you. Questions about which endings are used on which types of words and so forth. Which tenses have the same kinds of endings and this type of thing. So there's just some general observations. If you know the paradigm, you won't have any problem with them. If you don't know the paradigm, what?
Terminology for that can be from what we put on the board.
Right. Yeah. It's the same terminology we've used up there. So. Okay. Then. In other words, primary active and primary middle passive and secondary active, secondary middle passive, those terms. Then, you should be familiar with the basic way to translate the various possibilities of translating middle voice. And so if you just look what the book gave you, there's possibilities. You should be all right. Active, middle, and passive. In other words, know the distinction in the translation between active, middle, and passive. Now, there won't be any questions on this paradigm for AME. On this test, so you can maybe spare yourself a little bit of work there. You don't have to worry about AME, but you will have to be concerned about these deponent verbs and where they're deponent and so forth, the ones that I listed, erkomai, ginomai, and then the first five on that page 107. Okay. So other than that, if you spend your time studying that, learning that paradigm, you learn the paradigm and then learn the vocabulary for various the words that you'll be responsible for, you should be in pretty good shape. So that'll be next Tuesday. And that'll be our last test this semester. Okay, any other questions on that? All right, just come prepared. All right, lesson 19, let's take a look at that. This one is one we won't spend a lot of time with. It's more just a kind of review of what we've had already. It's a review of the first second declensions, but there's some new features in that it's breaking down the endings that we've had before a little bit differently. And I don't really care that you spend a lot of time rewriting your paradigms according to this scheme. In fact, it might be better that you don't. I think it's probably easier on the whole to learn the first and second declension just the way we've learned it and not worry about these morpheme breakdowns. But there is a reason to look at it this way, because when we get to the third declension, you'll find it's very appropriate, much more appropriate in third declension to analyze it in terms of these different morphemes. Because third declensions have a lot more complications as far as phonological changes and this type of thing are concerned. And it makes this morpheme analysis more appropriate for it. So let's just look at this and see what he's getting at. And like I said, I'm not going to require you to memorize anything in this chapter. This is mainly just for instruction and observational purposes. So section 141, in our discussion of linguistic structure, we referred briefly to morphemes as the smallest elements of language which have meaning. Although we have occasionally mentioned morphemes in succeeding lessons, we have been usually content to speak more vaguely of prefixes and suffixes, of endings, and still more generally of inflections. These vaguer terms serve very well for most purposes, but it's sometimes advantageous to use a more precise terminology based on more detailed analysis. Such an analysis will entail a review of the inflections learned so far and will reduce the total number of forms which need to be learned. Further, the analysis will provide a basis for the description of the inflections which still remain to be studied, namely third declension, as far as nouns are concerned. So we'll begin with nouns, and this kind of analysis will apply to verbs too, and we'll do some more of that with verbs later. But heretofore we have regarded each form of a noun as composed of two parts, an invariable part called the base, and a variable part which we have called the ending or inflection. The base may consist of one or more morphemes. One morpheme, for example, in the word, the morpheme tim in timé, or two morphemes, para and bol in parabole. But this is of no particular importance from our point of view, from the point of view of grammar. In other words, the base may have more than one morpheme in it, but those morphemes will be basically associated with the basic meaning of the word, not with the inflections on the endings. Now, we shall now show that each of the endings in the noun paradigm studied so far may be divided into two morphemes, a stem formative and a case number suffix. A stem formative and a case number suffix. Those are the two morphemes found in the endings on nouns. It will be convenient to arrange the nouns, the noun endings in a table for easy reference. So here's just a kind of repetition of our paradigm so far. We have chara, charas, chara, and so forth for first declension feminine. We have alpha type, then we ending in row there. We have timé, timés, timé, etc. There's your eta type first declension. We have doxa, doxés, doxé, doxan. That's your other kinds type of first declension. Neanias is your first declension masculine that ends in a vowel. And mathetes is a first declension masculine that doesn't end in a vowel. And logos is your second declension masculine in this case, but it would be the same for feminines. And ergon would be your second declension neuter. So that's all the types of endings we've seen so far for nouns. Now what's going to happen here is we're going to break this ending system down into two morphemes. Each of the endings in the table above may be divided into two morphemes, a stem formative and a case number suffix as indicated below. Now, there's a lot of rules here, or breakdowns for the way this, that's why I say this gets so laborious that it's really easier just to memorize the paradigm. But maybe we'll just take a look at this for a time and see what the what he's getting at in terms of putting these things together. And we'll get to the meanings of the morphemes in the last section here. Section 143, then, is indicating each of the endings in the table above may be divided into two morphemes. And number one, either the stem formative or the ending may be lacking. If either is lacking, it is said to be zero, represented by this little crosshatch symbol. So in some cases, the stem formative or the case number suffix will be a zero. In other words, there won't be anything there. And all you'll have is one or the other of those things. For example, see below, 2B1, 2B2, 2B, 2E2, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, well, this gets to be... Let's take a look at a few of these. Case number suffixes are as follows. Case number suffix will be usually the very last part of the ending. In the singular nominative, it's zero for all feminine nouns in the first declension. So singular nominative position now, the case number suffix is zero for all feminine nouns in the first declension. So all of those were ending in, you know, either alpha or eta. And the alpha or eta would be considered the stem formative. And there's zero after that, so it's considered zero. Then you had a new for neuter nouns of the second declension. So your nominative is going to have a nu for neuter nouns of the second declension and sigma for all of the nouns of the first and second declensions. So we either had a zero, a nu, or a sigma on that nominative position. So examples, Tim A, for example, it's Tim plus eta plus zero. The eta is the stem formative and the zero is the case number suffix. Aragon is erg plus omicron plus nu. The nu is your case number suffix. Mathetes is mathet plus a plus sigma. Eta plus sigma, the sigma is your case number suffix. Neonias, same thing, alpha plus sigma, the sigma is the case number suffix. And logos, the omicron plus sigma. So notice you've got the very last letter is either a sigma, a nu, or a zero, depending on whether it's second declension masculine, feminine, or second declension neuter, or first declension. Okay, then the singular genitive is the case number suffix is a sigma for feminine nouns of the first declension. It's omicron upsilon for all of the nouns of the first and second declensions. And so looking at the examples, we have Tim Ace. Tim plus eta plus sigma. So sigma is your case number suffix. Mathe 2, it's Mathe plus 0 plus omicron upsilon. Now they're calling the case number, the stem formative 0 and the case number suffix omicron upsilon. The same with logos. You can see what I'm getting at, I think. If you try to remember which... See, if you follow this format, then you have two paradigms to learn, in effect. You've got to learn the whole range of what the case number suffix does, and then you have to learn the whole range of what the stem formative does. I think it's easier just to memorize the paradigm. But you'll see that in third declension, though, it's a lot more useful to break things down this way, and I think it will actually save you some work when we look at the third declension, but not first, second declensions. That's why we kind of... rush over this chapter, and I don't think he intends you to spend a lot of time with it anyway. Singular dative, we have iota subscript there placed under the stem formative, and the long mark indicates the stem formative is lengthened if it is short. So in the singular dative, you're basically going lengthening the sound of the case number suffix, of the stem formative, and then putting an iota subscript under it. So for chara, for example, we have char plus alpha plus a lengthening in the iota subscript. Kome is kom plus eta plus a lengthening in the iota subscript. Logo is logo, and of course a lengthening of an eta doesn't change it any. Logo, yeah, and the same with an alpha. But logo does change. We get logo is log plus omicron plus a lengthening in the iota subscript, which makes it omega of the iota subscript. If you lengthen an omicron, it becomes an omega. But if you lengthen an eta, nothing happens. And if you lengthen an alpha, nothing happens to it. But you will get this iota subscript in all of those. So the dative has this indicative iota subscript in all of these paradigms. And so you can see a lengthening plus a iota subscript is the case number suffix in all cases, although the stem formative will vary. You see, the whole point is, when you look at these endings, you notice that some of them got alphas all the way through, some of them got etas all the way through, others have omicrons, O-type sounds. So it's convenient to separate those and call that the stem formative, the thing that's common to the whole paradigm of endings, if it's got a thematic alpha or eta or whatever. And then you can notice that a lot of these endings have the same last part, but a different first part. So that's the reason why they just divided them up according to these two morphemes. And as far as the meanings of those morphemes, we'll get to that a little bit later on here. One's basically telling you case and number, and the other one's telling you declension. Now, singular accusative is new for all nouns of the first second declensions. So that one's real regular. All of the nouns have a new, even though their stem formative may vary. Charan, Tiamain, Mathetain, Logon. So you'll have an alpha or an eta or an omicron for a stem formative, but the nu is the same in all of those. So that's your case number suffix. Plural nominative is alpha for all neuter nouns of the second declension, iota for all of the nouns of the first and second declensions. So notice we've always had plural nominative either had an alpha of the neuters or it had either alpha iota or omicron iota for everything else. And so it's convenient to call the iota this case number suffix and call the alpha or omicron, as it may be, the stem formative. Plural genitive, that one's real easy. Omega nu for all nouns. We'll just call this case stem formative zero and omega nu the ending, and they'll all be alike. So that one's real easy. And then the plural dative, iota sigma for all nouns of the first second declensions. Remember that we had either ice or ois for all of those forms in the neuter plural. And so it's convenient then just to call Iota Sigma, the ending, the case number suffix, and Alpha, the Alpha or Omega, the stem form. Accusative, it's a little bit more split up there. Alpha sigma for all first declension nouns, omicron upsilon for all masculine and feminine nouns of the second declension, and alpha for all neuter nouns. So basically, because there's not a real consistent pattern here for these, they're just calling the stem formative zero and just calling the whole thing the case number suffix. Stem formatives, now point number three, the stem formatives are as follows. A, zero if the case number suffix begins with a vowel other than iota. You see what I'm saying? You know, to try to memorize all these rules would be a lot harder than the paradigm. So for Timon, for example, if the suffix begins with a vowel other than iota, then you get a zero for the case number suffix. So this suffix begins with, but you have to know what the suffixes are first. And the suffix in this case is omega nu, and so we'll consider the case number suffix zero. And then for logos, same thing, omicron upsilon sigma, the case number suffix would be zero. B, it's alpha first declension nouns, except that I, for most first declension nouns, with bases ending in a consonant other than rho, the stem formative is eta in the singular. And then secondly, for some first declension nouns, with bases ending in a consonant other than rho, the stem formative is eta in the genitive and dative singular. These may be recognized from the dictionary forms. And then C, omicron for second declension nouns. So second declension nouns have an omicron all the way through, and then the basic dispute is between alpha and eta. Remember, there's some other kinds and this type of thing. So, like I said, there's a chart here that arranges all these suffixes neatly, I suppose. And you can see here, it's just summarizing the rules that we just read. And your nominative form is either going to have, for the case number suffix, a zero, a nu, or a sigma. And then it tells you which declension each one of those and which gender each one of those is going to be. The genitive will either have a sigma or an omicron upsilon and so forth. It's just a summarization of those rules. But again, it's really not that convenient to memorize, I don't think. But let's look at the meanings here and why he's getting at all of this. Then it gets perhaps the most important part of this chapter. And then we'll start into the third declension. Meaning of the morphemes. The stem formative morphemes mean the declension to which a noun belongs. In other words, the stem formative is your identifier of the declension. That is, the presence of the stem formative alpha means that the noun is of the first declension. The presence of the stem formative omicron means that the noun is of the second declension. If the stem formative is lacking, we cannot identify the declension. The case number suffix morphemes mean the case and number of the noun. So basically what he's doing is dividing it into two morphemes, the stem formative indicating the declension. And although in some forms you don't have a stem formative, so the declension's up for grabs, you know. In other words, in that particular form, you don't know for sure which the declension is. And for example, if you've got Mathe 2, for example, and that's the only form you ever saw that, you wouldn't necessarily know whether that was first or second declension, because the genitive singular is the same in first and second declension for masculine nouns. What was that?
That's all you
right, you probably wouldn't care, right? So, in other words, there's no morpheme there that's telling you for sure what the declension is, although the omicron upsilon will tell you what the case and number is. So that's the whole point of this. And the case number suffix morphemes mean the case and number of the noun. There's several notes here. Some morphemes have variant forms. For example, the case number suffix for the accusative plural may be alpha sigma, omicron upsilon sigma, or alpha. These variant forms of a morpheme are sometimes called allomorphs. Remember, I think we used that term way back when we talked about morphemes. In other words, they're the same morpheme but different forms. In other words, their meaning is accusative plural in this case, but they've got a different particular form. Then note number two, the term ending has been and will continue to be used in this book to refer to the combination of a stem formative with a case number suffix. In the future, we shall also make use of the term stem to refer to the combination of a base with a stem formative. So from now on, when he uses the term stem, he means the base plus the stem formative. rather than just what we've seen before, just chopping off the ending completely. And I think he'll use the term base for that, and he'll use the term stem for this. So it's based on this morpheme analysis. This isn't going to be too much of a problem, though, as you'll see as we go on. And what we're leading to now is the third declension. And I don't know how far to delve into this. I think we can go ahead and get started with it. But lesson 19, this one gets... I think I'm going to make this one optional for you. I think what we ought to do is we'll do 19A, but 19B you can do if you want to. Let's put it that way. That's just a matter of going through various words and writing down this analysis, you know, just writing down the stem formative and the case number suffix. And it's just a matter of copying what you see over here, basically. I don't think it's really going to add much to our understanding of things. If you'd like to do it, you're certainly welcome to, but I don't think we'll take the time in class to go through it that way. But 19A, I think we will take a look at, and we'll see. We'll have a test next time, so we won't have time to do that. Maybe Wednesday we'll maybe just go through that in class, and if you get the time to run through it, fine. If not, we'll just do it in class. Okay, so 19A for maybe next Wednesday. Optional to do that, and you certainly don't try to spend a lot of time. In other words, don't sacrifice test studying time for doing exercise 19B. But if you want to do it, you're all done with everything else. You don't have anything to do at the end of the semester. You know, all your other tests are taken care of, and so forth. Go ahead and do it. Be interesting to ask what's the probability that anybody will do that. What was that?
Famous revolution.
Yeah, right. That's about right.
Well, I'm sure.
Okay. Do we have any questions, though, on chapter 19? As to what's happening to it? See, all this is doing really is... And some of this is contrived. I mean, I think it's probably just invented. It's just a contrivance to try to see some parallels. You see, what the observations are that you seem to have consistent vowels in certain declensions. First declensions have lots of alphas in them. Second declensions have O sounds in them. So because of that observation, and because the last part of the endings in some cases is similar to each other in first and second declension, then it becomes plausible then to separate these things up into two morphemes. But when you do, you have to do a lot of contriving. You know, you have to call this one zero because it didn't have something consistent and so forth. There's just a lot of it can be playing games here, you know, as far as actual... The Greeks may not have been looking at all at that type of thing when they set it up. And when the Holy Spirit, you know, when God came down at the Tower of Babel and made a transformation in their languages, they probably had the paradigms complete. And he may have had something involved there, but who knows really how rigidly we ought to take these things. I think it's really much simpler in the first and second declension just to memorize the endings, memorize the paradigms, and then notice certain thematic patterns in them. But in the third declension, you'll see, though, that because of the fact that we get certain of the suffixes are consonantal suffixes that when added onto a stem that ends with a consonant result in phonological problems. And that's where most of our suffixes so far have been just vocalic suffixes. They began with a vowel. And you can add a vowel onto a vowel, or you can add a vowel onto a consonant, no problem. But just like we've seen with verbs where we tried to add sigmas onto the stem for future forms and aorist forms, we had certain phonological changes because sigmas didn't go on to nus and things like that. Or when they went on to v's and so forth, you got to change to a z. The same kind of thing is going to happen with third declension. And that's the reason, part of the reason why such an analysis is convenient. So let's take a look then at chapter 20 and get started with this. This will get you initiated for next time. We won't be doing exercises or anything till next semester, but I think it'd be good for you to kind of see where we're headed as far as third declension is concerned. And third declension is very important not only because of the fact that it's one of the declensions of nouns, but your participles are going to depend on third declension endings. In fact, you may see more third declension endings in participles than you do in nouns. And participles turn out to be one of the most important parts of Greek grammar. So before we can get into participles and talk about them, we need to know something about third declension. Okay, section 146. Nouns of the third declension may be divided into subclasses as follows. And you can see there's quite a few subclasses. A, nouns whose bases end in a consonant and which have no stem formative, or put differently, which have zero as a stem formative. These are collectively called consonant stems. So what we're talking about is a noun that ends in a consonant and has no stem formative, no little vowel or something to make the transition between the stem and the base, you might say, and the ending. So this means that in some cases we're going to have to be adding a consonantal ending to a consonantal stem, and that's where these phonological changes occur. And they divide these in a fairly similar fashion to the way we've divided grouped verbs when we added sigmas onto them. Notice the categories. First, we have major consonant stems, which include in turn labial stems, nouns whose end nouns whose bases end in P, beta, or phi. Remember P, beta, or phi? When you added sigma on, became C. So that was the same grouping that we saw before. And then, although I think we have P, tau there also. Then velar stems, nouns whose bases end in kappa, gamma, or chi. So those are the ones, too, that we've seen before. See, we're going to have a sigma being added. A sigma is one of the endings in the third declension. And so this is why we're classifying the same way. Then dental stems, nouns whose bases end in tau but not nu tau, delta, or theta. So nu tau is eliminated here because that's got a different, it's more like a nu type of situation. So those are your major consonant stems, and those are very much like the ones we've seen, the considerations we've seen before as far as our adding sigmas to our bases on verbs. Then secondly, minor consonant stems, which include in turn a nasal stems, nouns whose bases end in nu or nu tau. And these, as far as verbs are concerned, when things ended in nu, you usually had just an irregularity when you added the sigma. Those are the ones that were irregular in the future, got an accent shift or a stem change or something like that. With third declension nouns, we see some different things happening with those too. Then liquid stems, nouns whose bases end in lambda or rho.
Okay.
So the bases ending in any one of these are going to generate complications as far as the endings are concerned, and they're going to do different things. That's why we have to break them down. Then that's the first category. Then B, nouns whose bases end in upsilon, preceded by a consonant, and which have no stem formative. These are called upsilon stems. Okay, so if we've got the stem ending, the bases ending in upsilon, again, no stem formative, and these are called upsilon stems. And there's quite a few of those. And then C, nouns whose bases end in either a consonant or a vowel, and which have as stem formatives, iota alternating with epsilon, these are the iota stems, two, epsilon upsilon alternating with epsilon, these are epsilon upsilon stems, and three, omicron eta or epsilon, the so-called sigma stems. Now you might wonder what it's called a sigma stem for if it's omicron eta or epsilon. But I think he gives a little footnote here. The so-called, because in pre-Greek times the stem ended in sigma, we retain the name to avoid confusing with these with omicron stems of the second declension. So just call it something from ancient times here, and at least it keeps it separate from confusing with something else as far as second declension is concerned. And this last category, these so-called sigma stems, in some books they analyze that even as a fourth declension because they're so strange. I mean, as far as... It's almost as though you have to memorize a new paradigm on those because the endings get so different. Yes?
Is it going to be possible to form a nice neat paradigm like that for the first and
second? Well, not quite. Yeah. Again, here, because of all these phonological changes, we're having to deal with each one of these. Now, they're not... Most of these are having to do with something that happens to the base just before the ending, and it's still okay as far as the endings are concerned. Once you learn the endings, then you're pretty fine until you get to this category C is the hardest one, and of those, number three is the hardest of those. And the reason is it wouldn't be so hard if the iota or the on the iota stems, if it was always iota, it wouldn't be so hard. But it says iota alternating with epsilon. So the stem has some of them have iotas and some of them have epsilons. That's the hard thing. The actual ending that you stick onto, it's no problem. But it's this stem, you see. And then the epsilon-upsilon stems, you have sometimes epsilon-upsilon, sometimes epsilon. If they were epsilon-upsilon all the way through, then it wouldn't be that difficult because you could just stick your regular old endings on there and you'd have it if you just remembered that the stem was the same. But that, I think, is where the major complications come. And as far as the major consonant stems up here, the labial stem and so forth, there's some basic principles to learn, but after that, I wouldn't consider those real difficult either. So we will be able to draw a paradigm for third declension, but we have to make it more complicated with these additional features. That's the problem with it. That's why we've separated. That's why they haven't given it to you at the first. First declension, second declension, you can just write down the forms, basically. But third declension, it takes a lot more work. Okay. So that's what we're headed for. That's a synopsis, really, of what we're going to be looking at for the next few chapters and the next month or so, or whatever it takes to get through this. Not quite that long, but the next few chapters anyway. Okay, so moving on, section 147. In the present lesson, we shall consider only the first subclass, that of the major consonant stems. Nouns of this subclass may be analyzed into stem or base plus case number suffix, since the stem formative in this class is zero. The case number suffixes appropriate to the major consonant stems are as follows. So here's a different ending system than what you've seen before. These are the endings that are going to be attached, and the masculines or feminines are going to be the same, and then the neuters will be a little bit different. And the differences in the neuters, again, are going to occur in the nominatives and accusatives, just like we saw before. So that pattern does continue. Okay, for your nominative singular suffix, masculine or feminine, the ending is sigma. And that's where one of the problems comes. How do you add a sigma onto, you know, something else that's got a consonant stem? And then genitive is omicron sigma. Now, this is why I mentioned to you before that omicron sigma is one you have to watch, because omicron sigma is also the nominative case ending for the second declension nouns. And that's the way we've been normally seeing it. And what will typically happen is the student will learn the nominative paradigm, you know, second declension, the common paradigm, and then he's looking at the text and he sees something with omicron sigma on it, and he assumes that it's nominative second declension, but it's not. It's genitive third declension. And so you have to watch out for those. You'll be able to recognize most of these after a while, but yes, usually if the article's on it, you can tell. You know, the article. See, fortunately, third declension isn't going to have a new article system. It's going to use the same articles we've seen before. So, because of that, if it has the article or if it has an adjective, you can usually tell. Unless, of course, there's a third declension adjective too. In some cases, you'll have a third declension adjective, and you have both of them have omicron sigma. If there's no article on it, then you really would have to know the dictionary form in order to know whether it's third declension, or the syntax will usually tell you too, because if you read the whole sentence, it's seldom that you're going to get a nominative and a genitive form confused in the sentence structure. If it's looking like it's nominative, but it's not the subject of a sentence, and it's modifying another noun, then you've got to say, well, this must be genitive. So once you are aware of these things, but you see lots of, you know, like I say, the student that knows enough Greek to be dangerous is the one who, he sees the word in the interlinear, and then he looks it up in the concordance and so forth, and he's not really looking at context or other things. He doesn't really know the grammatical rules that let him know that the garticle would tell him what it is, you know. He doesn't know that much yet. And you can all think back to, you know, the days when you didn't know much Greek grammar. Hopefully those days are over. And you can look at a lot of forms, but they really don't mean. And then you look them up in the concordances and so forth, look them up in lexicons, and they tell you what they are, and you still don't know what they are. I mean, they give you all the terminology, but what does that mean? What's a genitive, you know? So it does help to have some knowledge of grammar in deciding these forms. So really, I don't think there'll be any problem for you in discerning between these, but I just note that there's been a lot of confusion about this. The dative is just an iota ending, and the accusative is an alpha. In your plurals, the nominative is epsilon sigma. Genitive is good old omega nu, even in the third declension. In fact, even through that oddball fourth declension type of thing, it's omega nu. So that's consistent all the way through. That's our friend, yeah. Okay. The dative is sigma iota with optional nu. So here we get a movable nu type situation even on a noun. And then accusative is alpha sigma. Now your neuters are slightly different. The genitive and dative forms are the same. And that's the same thing we've seen with first and second declension. Or second declension, I should say. There's no first declension neuters. But the nominative forms have a zero for the case number suffix also. So there's just no ending at all. Your nominative singular on a third declension noun is just the stem with nothing on it, period. And same with the accusative. The accusatives and the nominative forms are the same again, just like we've seen before. And then in the plurals, you have alphas, That's the same thing you had in the second declension for your nominative plural and your accusative plural. But the genitive and dative will be just like the masculines and feminines. Okay. And there is another positive point as far as third declensions. Your masculine and feminine forms are the same. You don't have a separate, you know, masculine and feminine. Isn't that nice? So, you know, you ought to rejoice for everything that's simplified here. Okay, so remark number one here, though, and there's three form remarks here. When the case number suffixes sigma and sigma iota nu are added to the bases of this subclass, the usual phonological or orthographic modifications occur. So that just like you saw with your verb, see, we've got a couple endings now, the dative plural and the nominative singular that have a beginning with an S. The nominative singular is just plain a sigma, and the dative plural is sigma iota nu. So when you add that onto the base, you're going to get the same phonological changes we've seen before. And that's why the reason that this class is sub-broken down into the labial, velar, and dental stems, just like we saw with the verbs. So if you add the sigma onto P, beta, or phi, the result is a psi. And so this noun will end with psi. If it is added on, if the base ends in kappa, gamma, or chi, it's going to result in xi, just like we saw with the verbs. And if it's tau, delta, or theta, that's going to turn to just a plain sigma. In other words, the tau, delta, or theta will just drop off, and you have a sigma on it. And then the same is true of the neuter plural. It's psi, iota, nu, xi, iota, nu, or just sigma, iota, nu. If you look, well, maybe I better... Now let's go ahead and look over at this first paradigm just to observe this feature of it. On page 115, you first have some labial stems here. First a P stem, hey lilops. Now lilops is the dictionary form, nominative form, but that C in the end is the result of a P and a sigma added to it. So P plus sigma is C. If you look at the genitive form, you get tes lilopos. You see? Now this... Maybe I can just say this now, and we'll get to it in a little bit. Suppose you had a word like, hey, lilops, and you looked up in the dictionary and so forth, and all you had was a nominative form. Could you tell from that form what the base was, for sure? No, you couldn't. Because, yeah, it could be beta. It could be, you know, lilops from a beta, adding a sigma to it. Or it could be because it was a phi. So it could have been lilof or lilob or lilop as the base.
Or lollipop.
Okay. We're getting too much Greek here in one semester, I think. It started taking its toll at the end. All right? Now, this is why the genitive form is also given on these third declensions. Because if you got the genitive form, then you know what the base was. See, the genitive form will tell you, because the genitive form, the ending was only omicron sigma, and that can be added onto the base without any phonological changes. So that's why they'll, in the dictionary, it'll be, you know, it'll say, hey, lilops, and then they'll either write out the whole, depending on how they print it, then either put lilopos, the genitive form, after that in parentheses, or maybe just the P omicron sigma. In other words, it wouldn't be just the omicron sigma. They put the P. In other words, they tell you what the base was, in effect. So the genitive form will determine the base. Now, the dative form would too, and so would the accusative form, but the genitive is the first one in the paradigm that does it, so that's the form that they use. So that's the reason why these third declension nouns need to give you some information on that, because you will not be able to uniquely determine the base if you've got only the nominative form because of these phonological changes. And because several different endings have the base endings end up with the same phonological change, that's the reason you can't uniquely determine it. Yes?
So this, the inclusion of the genitive in the dictionary tells you two things, the base
mm-hmm.
and then it's third declension.
It'll tell you that it's third declension also, right. Yeah, it'll tell you both things. It'll tell you it's third declension and tell you what the base is. Okay.
So, like right down here at the bottom of 148, chronos plus phone, is that the way you see it in the dictionary?
Yes, right. Well, it depends. It depends on dictionary to dictionary. You know, some of them don't put the whole thing. They just put the last few letters, you know, so you can see it. So, but basically that's it, yeah. You'd have to check, you know, different reference works use a little slightly different system as far as exactly what they're going to duplicate, but they all will give you the genitive form someplace there so that you can see it, and then in the article. So that's a typical heading, you know, canopos, and then ho, Okay. All right. Let's be prepared for the test next time then. And I'm sure that test will take the whole hour. So Wednesday we'll get back to this. Yes. Okay.